emotion, our first reaction is to think about it. And thinking causes a gap between our and the experience. But sometimes the phonic contradict with the method of inquiry or that I don't understand how it works. Because when I think about to inquire something, I usually think that it involves the mind, involves thinking about something. So if you say that thinking causes us to separate from the experience, so how does inquiry work?
Yeah, good question. I think you have to acknowledge that there are different ways of thinking. If you wanted different categories in Buddhist psychology, you would speak of different degrees of collectedness, different degrees of mindfulness. Yeah? You have two crucial qualities. One of them is sati, which I generally translate with awareness, attention. There's a whole range of words which don't quite cover its quality, but it means a quality of mind that is capable of both identifying individual aspects of experience, and while these aspects change, to continually witness them. This is a quality that is capable of holding several aspects of experience. It's possible to hold in peripheral attention a variety of discrete objects. It is possible to cultivate this quality to make it more sticky to the object, yeah? To make it more dexterous, more mobile. It is possible to make this quality more resilient against things that want to take you away from the object. So this quality called sati is one of the things that makes a difference in how we think. The other quality is obviously samatha, is the type of unification of mind, the stillness of mind, or the samadhi or samatha, both are roughly the same. So a thought that you, an inquiry, let's put it like that, an inquiry that you hold depends on its quality from what degree of sati is here, what degree of samadhi is here. How long and how profoundly can you hold an object of experience before your mind starts commenting? The inquiry is more profound the more uncertainty, the more not knowing, the more openness you can muster. The faster your mental reaction, the more it will consist of things you already know. In fact, the faster the reaction is, the less profound the inquiry will be. A good inquiry always asks difficult questions. It always asks things it doesn't know. A good inquiry, in fact, consists of a good question, not of good answers. You know, the quality of inquiry generally produces a quality of quiet, of a capacity of not knowing. Now, most of the times when I inquire, you know, I just go past my memory banks, I rifle through the files of experience, and I come up with some probability statement. Or worse, an opinion. You know, I know already. I don't need to inquire. I've seen this. Now, sometimes that's true. You know, say for something like traffic, that's most of the things you do. You know, you realize how a stop sign looks. You don't need to really inquire into that stop sign. You need to recognize it. You need to act on it. But if you actually do want to inquire, then the quality of your inquiry doesn't depend on the speed of your cognitive dexterity, you know, how fast you can move or how high you can jump in your head or how big thoughts you can have. It depends largely on how much mindfulness you are, is there, how much you're capable of focusing, and how much you're capable of holding unknowns. You know, how comfortable are you with not knowing? The more uncomfortable you are with not knowing, the faster you will try to name, explain, judge, evaluate. So, obviously, such an inquiry needs thinking, a type of thinking. At the same time, it needs a type of thinking that doesn't just repeat or regurgitate what it already knows. Am I clear?
Mm-hmm.
This is a very crucial question our friend has asked here, because how do I discern whether what's happening now is inquiry or whether it's just reflective thinking? How do you know that? One way to know is how much space is there in between your thoughts. How big are the gaps? How much space is there at all? Yeah? Now, this is an almost energetic experience. I cannot give you a definite criteria, but you go in there and you feel how much space is there around this thought. Many years ago, I have practiced Aikido a lot. This is a wonderful thing to do. And I always realized my Aikido is good when I have the feeling there is plenty of time to respond to the movements of my partner. Whenever I had the feeling I have to be in a hurry, there is no time, God, is he coming fast, I knew I was bad. I knew I was off center. Now, with thoughts, it's very similar. If it just does this kind of thing all the time, you realize you can't trust this. Now, you cannot identify the content individually and say, you're no good, that doesn't count, this is old stuff. You need to judge the quality by a generic measure. You need to judge the quality by the pitch, or by the speed, or by the density. Now, in my own language, I call this reactiveness. You know, it's just old stuff, reacting. It's my conditioning jumping up, reacting, you know. And something in me knows that this is okay for recognizing traffic signals. It's not okay of recognizing motivation. It's not enough to recognize intentionality. It's not enough to recognize texture of emotional qualities. Yeah. To be able to actually understand something like an emotion, you need to be able to feel it. You need to be able to inhabit it. Yeah. You need to have some kind of confidence that you can go there and be with it without enacting it, you know, without doing what it says. You know, to be able to investigate anger, you need to feel confident enough to actually hold it. If you feel it's holding you, then you're going to be angry. You know, you're going to say angry things, do angry things, look angrily, think angry thoughts. Whether you're more the expansive extrovert who enacts outside, or whether you're more the auto-aggressive type who goes into a self-hating spiral, this is a matter of temperament. But to be able to investigate something like anger, you need to have a confidence that you can be with anger without being just angry. That there is something else than just that experience. But there is a continuum in which that experience takes place, pleasant or unpleasant, and that experience is just a content rather than you. Now, as long as you think it's me, then when you're angry, you're just angry. When you're happy, you're just happy, and so forth. So one of the things sati and samadhi are doing, they provide a containment. They provide a container for our experience. I allow myself, because I have confidence that I'm going to be with this sitting still, I have the confidence that I can actually go and inquire into this. And that inquiry will be in parts unpleasant if I have to investigate anger. It will be tinged with experience of shame, of all kinds of things. And it will also hold an exquisite energy which I need and I really want to use in my life. Yeah? So to be able to get at the good stuff, I need to be able to have the capacity to hold the unpleasant first. Then the one which is disturbing to myself view. You know, the shame. There's all kinds of difficult things on that way. What I wanted to say is, the habitual way of getting away from something unpleasant is think. Usual pang reactive distancing pattern. I think your mistake. You know, it feels unpleasant here because you made a mistake. That means I can safely go away from my feeling unpleasant here and declare you as the responsible person for that experience. I can say, but you should have done better. I would say, you shouldn't really do that. You've done that yesterday, and if you do that again, you're really going to be having difficulties with it. Yeah? I can focus my attention out. I deflect from being here with the help of my mind to going to you and attribute responsibility to you for what's happening here. Now, indeed, you may have stepped on my toe, and my pain will indeed have something obvious to do with my pain, but also, my pain doesn't explain my anger. You know, there's no reason for me to be angry with you when you cause me pain. I can tell you this causes pain and you will say sorry. There's no logical or no psychological need for me being angry with you. Yeah? So in giving you responsibility, not just for my pain, but also for my anger, I disown. I pretend this anger has nothing to do with me. It has just to do with what you do. On one level, this is easy, because it doesn't make me responsible for the anger. On another level, it makes me powerless, because it makes you responsible for my experience, which is a disaster. Yeah? In the long run. So for me to be able to actually inquire into this process, I need to have some stability. I need to have some safety. I need to have some confidence that I can do this, you know, that I'm not going mad. Or we all have favorite fears. If you want to test out your favorite fears, then look, ask us. There's not so many different fears, really. Generally, they boil down to 3 or 4. Some people are more afraid of being abandoned and lost. You know, I'm here and it doesn't matter to anybody. Other people are more afraid of being rejected. You know. There is something I really love, and I seem to matter to this something, but it rejects me. Other fear. There is something, but it's probably going to eat me up. It's too big. It's too strong. It's going to engulf me. It's going to gobble me up. So I can't exist with it. You know, either I'm here and nothing matters. Invalidation, abandonment, or I'm here and I'm being rejected, it doesn't want me.
All boils down to losing the self.
Yeah. because there isn't one. Mm-hmm. Yes, it boils down to that. And the other one is obviously you're being annihilated by something bigger. Exactly as our friend in blue says, the loss of self. You know, my major fears rotate around the loss of self. And obviously the problem is these fears are really justified, not because because there isn't a self. One of the difficult things about a self, it's not that it's bad. The problem is, because it doesn't exist, we have to keep making one up. Yeah? It's makeshift. It's patchwork. We have to cobble it up. And guess what it does? It fritters away. It's disappearing all the time. You know, we have to repair it because it cannot exist on itself. You see? The sense of self is a cognitive construction. We impose a cognitive mode on our primary experience. This thought, finally, I know who I am. Next one, please, tell me who I am. Yeah. You know, and the bad thing is, we're not just identifying with good things. You know, that would be easy enough. Gives pleasure, gratification, joy, lust, whatever. You know, this is understandable that we like this and say, oh yeah, I am a happy person. The tragic thing is, we are so unwilling to bear uncertainty of who we are and what is, that we're quite happy to identify with horrible things. I'm a loser, I'm a failure, I'm totally irresponsible, I've let her down. Yeah, we're quite happy to identify with this, because at least it tells us something about us. It makes us feel horrible, it makes us unhappy, and as you notice, it's unhappy people who make other people unhappy. It's not the happy ones that are the problem, it's the unhappy ones that make other people unhappy. So we make ourselves unhappy with this act of identifying with something destructive. You know, I'm really bad, I'm really bad, I'm a really bad person. Yeah. At least I know who I am. Yeah. It's unpleasant, it doesn't give me a chance to relate to this world, but it tells me who I am. In some grotesque way, if you see what people identify with, you know, deeply, there's some really, really heart-wrenching statements about ourselves we have identified with, we believe. And obviously, we're going to come across these things when we meditate. You know, these things will kind of well up. When we meditate, we make the threshold more thin. We make ourselves more porous. Not just for the light to come in, but also some of the things to come up. Yeah? One of my teachers, the man who made me a monk, said always, meditation is a controlled breakdown. You gradually allow yourself to get in touch with the worst things, with the things you never wanted to have anything to do. The things you have built up all your defenses against. Yeah? So, I'm not sure whether I'm still on track with answering that question.
Which was very interesting.
The quality of inquiry depends on mindfulness and it depends on collectedness of mind, samadhi. Now, you have to establish for yourself subjectively how it feels when you are mindful and when you are collected. I can just tell you what it feels for me. Mindfulness is an abstract quality. It is something that is always there. In fact, we have serious mental problems if it isn't there, but it isn't there always in the same measure, to the same extent. When I have a good mindfulness, I understand this because I get many feedbacks in my experience. I ask body, how are you feeling? And I get many messages. If my mindfulness is tired or bored or flat or broken or crumbly or lazy or so, I say, well, there's nothing much happening really. Just normal. Wait. Well, there's a twitch in my left shoulder. Something in my nose. That's it. Yeah, end of story. So I get very disparate, very imprecise feedback. I only notice that I have good mindfulness when the feedback I get from my body is textured. When I sense there's much coming back. I have differentiated complex feedback. It tells me something about the quality of my mindfulness, of my capacity to be present with something. Yeah? Take that word literally. The fullness of mind brought to the present moment. If the feedback from what is happening in the present moment is skimpy, superficial, caricature, then you realize your sati is probably not really up to scratch right now. How do you identify collectedness of mind? For me, the primary experience is space. There is this, but there is also a lot more. Yeah, it is situated in space. It's a primary, it's a genuine sense of openness, of spaciousness, of availability. It does talk, and yet I have choices. I can see its beginning, or I can see its end, or I can see its movement. There's many things I can do. I can go towards, I can go away, I can go to this, yeah. And there is not just that. It is something in context. So, and then obviously, if the collectedness increases, if the samadhi increases, it becomes, there's specific tones you learn to identify. Some of them have to do with clarity, with vision, with centeredness, with something exquisitely blissful. A quality of exquisite blissfulness comes to this. Stillness. Delicious. Nice. Multiplied by three. No, potentized by three. And I think you learn to identify your mind in the state of thinking. You learn to identify when the process seems to slow down and become more deep. It sounds less competent. You know, the deeper you go, the less competent you sound. The level where you seem to know everything is the most superficial level, because that level represents more or less one-to-one your previous experience. It represents what you already know. Every profounder insight grows out of the soil of uncertainty. You do not really know. So you learn to distinguish in yourself. If it sounds too confident and too quick and too solid, you know, I know this doesn't count. I need to bear uncertainty. That's the prime precondition for getting deeper, is not knowing. And to hold this not knowing without twitching, without jumping towards, without jumping away or towards, without judging, without, yeah, there's something unwavering which goes together with samadhi. It's something that is willing to stay still, non-reactiveness, spaciousness, openness, willingness to be with. There's a fundamentally welcoming quality to mindfulness. It's something soft that allows in and also allows out. These things. I hope this helps. Please.
And just to follow on that, just remember that in states of deep concentration or meditation, when I try to raise like big questions, they're often sounds hollow and meaningless.
Maybe they are. Also, you have to distinguish, you see. Mindfulness is capable of being with things, all things. Samatha is generally with one object, either an object of meditation or something abstract, emptiness, spaciousness. You know, there's different schools of meditation depending what you do. The early Buddhism has a tendency to go for objects and concentrate on objects. Not just. It's not as exclusive as most Burmese teachers tell you, but there is a definite tendency. The mind absorbs into one object. Say, physical sensation, breath, or a thought, or an image, a nimitta. Yeah? So concentration occurs when you are with this and you absorb into this, when you are no longer separate from this. There's also other ways of being concentrated than with objects. Now, sometimes when you are with an object, you don't want to inquire. Inquiry disturbs. You know, the mind sometimes wants to stay still there. there's something that doesn't want to be disturbed anymore. It wants to go in there and just be there and be blissful. That's what most of us want to do. You know, we think so much and we get tired of this. We like to just go out, be happy, just stop thinking. And for much of the time we do that. We identify thinking with the problem. We have the idea if we stop thinking, that's the solution of the problem. We only suffer when we think. Well, now that's not the truth. There are some problems that are persisting even if we stop thinking about them. It's a very superficial understanding. Sometimes you see people go around and say, the problem is thinking. Just stop thinking, everything is fine. That's true. Thinking is one of the biggest meditation obstacles. But it doesn't mean that thinking, stopping to think, means stopping the problem. It's a preliminary obstacle. It doesn't mean it's the problem as such. The problem is deeper. We're not just attached to thoughts, we're also attached to states. One of such states may be happiness coming from meditation. There's also something very controlled about samatha. Yeah. It's safe. You can make yourself happy, you can go someplace, nobody can hurt you. That's very attractive for most people. Safety from overwhelming emotions, from obsessive thought, from conditions, other people making you happy or unhappy. Suddenly you have found something that you can make yourself happy with. That's very attractive. One of the reasons why it's attractive is because we can choose. Yeah. Now, there is a great blessing to such a happiness, but there is also a great danger. In many ways it's just another attachment, you know. It's a bit less bad for your teeth than ice cream, but basically it's still an attachment. So notice if you find your mind making a question hollow. Now, it may be that the question isn't really relevant. That's what makes it hollow. It may be a question that you have imported from another level. And you really find it's not accurate. It is the wrong question. Or it's badly formulated. Maybe it is the resistance of your mind to actually inquire, because you're currently just about attaching. You think, most people think their samadhi is never good enough. In fact, I know very, very few people who think that their samadhi is good enough. Even if their samadhi is very good, they still may think, well, actually, it was third jhana only rather than fourth, you know. So there is a tendency in us to think, well, first we'll get through these absorptions and then we are going to investigate. So it may be the resistance of a mind that is already concentrated to actually use the concentration to investigate. And it would rather just like to be happy and continue being where it is. That may also be a reason. I think you will have to look, so be prepared that you have resistance of a mind on the path to concentration, but also maybe the question itself has become irrelevant, or it is a question that comes from another, that comes from the thinking level. You know, who am I is a very useful question on one level, because it makes you relate in a very personal way to what's happening. On another level, who am I is a perfectly wrong question, because it doesn't make sense to appropriate experience anymore. If you are profoundly aware and in a meditative frame of mind, then this doesn't make sense to say, well, who am I? I mean, why should I construct an I out of what's happening now? It seems so gross, it seems so crude. At the same time, this is a very, very useful question. On a less meditative level.
Yeah, not all questions have to come from the thinking mind, even the deep ones.
See, if you can formulate it as a question, the thinking mind has some part in it. You cannot think in an absorption. One of the things that makes an absorption is that there is no cognitive thought. no conceptual discursive thought anymore. Only the first absorption has some very minimal vitakka vichara, very subtle residual thought. So you cannot think in third jhana. When you dare, there is no inquiry possible. Inquiry is possible on the way in or on the way out, particularly on the way out, because your obstacles are flat, the terrain is better, the view is better, but you cannot really inquire much. Often insight doesn't happen at the deepest level. It happens on the threshold. That's my experience. I'm not perfect, and there are probably people who disagree with me and people who would agree with me. Important is that you question. How valid is this question? Is the reason that it sounds hollow the unwillingness of the mind to actually bother with it? If you're very will-oriented and focused and you've possibly good concentration, this may well be the case. Or is the reason that the question is hollow because it doesn't seem appropriate anymore? All questions have premises, and maybe the premises are wrong. You know, there's always a prior type of understanding. Please?
It's about the selfing tendencies in group. Because the selfing tendencies I feel are very, very strong and very tricky. And sometimes they can, like, you know, shift from being identified with oneself to being identified with a group self. From football fans to nations in wars to being a Buddhist to Buddhism to DFP group. And now I think I feel we are in a process of forming, we are not, this group is in a process of forming itself. And is there a possibility for a group to become without strengthening so much the walls of you know, we are the DFP and it has got this and that principles, and then it's a very self group with very good intentions, keeping in this tricky way this tendency of a self of something to hold you.
Let me see whether I get that correctly. You're asking me, selfing or identification with content of experience as on an individual level, when we try to form a group, just turns into me being a member of this group and this group having this and this content. You know, this is a program, this ideology or this feature.
And keeping you away from freedom as I see it, of not being identified with.
So instead, just basically doing the same psychological process, trying to attach to one type of experience and trying to defend against the other type. We just do the whole thing as a group. Yeah. Well, obviously, that's what most groups do. And I don't think you can stop that to some degree. What you can do is you can reflect that process. One of the things that helps in meditation is to make things conscious. Yeah. To allow that part of experience onto the screen, which has so far not been allowed up onto the screen. Yeah, we do that psychologically. And in groups, obviously the same holds true. A good group is capable of reflecting on its goals. A good group is capable of holding transparent the way it operates. So transparency is a very good value. Individually, you speak of, you know, how much self-revelation takes place. How open can I be? How present can I be with all of myself? Some bits I like to be present with. Yeah, I like you to see those bits. Some bits I don't like you to see those bits. Same holds true for a group. A, that the group starts establishing a way of relating to what it does and what it doesn't. Yeah? So that there is some kind of reflective level, that there is a space in the group that speaks about what it does before it has problems, not just when it has problems. Yeah? And there are various ways that help. Acknowledge diversity, for example. Acknowledge, not just tolerate differentness, but actually actively welcome people being different, having different skills, backgrounds, competences. Hold a space. Have a capacity as a group to hold a space that is not known. Yeah. The more organized you are, the more items on the agenda are, the less you will hold space, the more you will hold topics, you will hold business. So a group, for me, has some quality in the capacity of conflict it is capable of holding, the capacity, the degree of transparency it is capable to hold, the degree of diversity it is capable to hold. Now, all these things are difficult, because one of the things that makes us be in a group is that we have identified a similar goal or a similar need. Yeah, and in that, we want to acknowledge some similarity. Some. At the same time, we have to acknowledge that we are also individuals. Yeah, that dreaded, hated individual we wanted to get rid of, to just acknowledge anicca dukkha anatta for many years, trying to stop being a self, we have actually to be able to say, well, we're not just a self, but we're different. Needs are different, skills are different, experience is different, competence is different. We have different degrees of feeling safe. And these are all difficult things. And the more you are willing to address this, the more alive your group will go, and the less you will be acting from shadow stuff. You know, the groups is, we're about this, and then we repress that. Like the psyche says, I'm a good person, so I don't have any bad sides. Groups will do this every time you see that. The more the group is capable of reflecting this itself and addressing it, naming it, bearing with the unpleasantness of saying we want to have one goal and yet we are in disagreement. That's what groups experience all the time. Why should I go in a group if they just quarrel? So you go in a group to team up, then you find the more you try to team up, the more different things become. And you say, I don't want to go there because, you know, I wanted a group that was the opposite, that was solid and reliable, good, fine, honest, down-to-earth Buddhists, you know, and now they turn out to be all kinds of things. That's what we find out. One of my greatest sufferings in Buddhist monastic life, my initial suffering really, was what I thought monasteries were and what I found out monasteries were like. I found it really difficult.
Is it important to define,
yes,
being a Buddhist? Why? Being not Buddhist or New Age or whatever.
It's important to be clear. It's not so important to be defining, but it's important to be clear. And generally, clarity comes from identifying values. Not so much behavior, but values. What matters to you? Because you don't have a choice about this. You have a choice about knowing or not knowing. You have a choice about acknowledging or repressing. You have a choice about affirming or denying, but you don't have a choice about that some things matter to you and other things don't. The more you know what matters to you, the more clear a group, in analogy to this, is capable of identifying a value, the more it will come back to common ground. Now, generally, we try to identify ourselves through outward signs, behavior. I wear this kind of hat, you know. was in Jerusalem last night, Erev Shavuot. Great number of different hats. You see, yeah? It's obviously a great significance to which type of hat you wear. Buddhists do the same. They have more subtler ways in some ways. The monastic Buddhists definitely have no more subtler ways. You know, they roll their robes this way or that way, slightly more orange, slightly more ochre. They use a little more this dye. They wear their arms bow on the left side, on the right side. I know much about Orthodox Judaism just by looking at it, because I have been an Orthodox Buddhist, you know, and I recognize great, great similarities. not in the outward form, but in the underlying pattern, you know, of distinguishing oneself, adhering to, making this, you know. So I think you have to establish, rather than behavior, you have to establish values. And then you have to establish process, obviously, how you go about being such a group.
I'll be more personal.
Yeah.
I find my values, as far as I can find them, look at them, fitting into more than just one stream of ideas. I find the meditation way, I even don't want to say the Buddhist way, the meditation way useful as a bath or whatever to take me, what I believe, closer to my values or in my values. But still, I don't want to identify myself as the bus number 3 or number whatever. Going there, but then I hear even you coming here and saying Buddhism and not Buddhism, and I can't really find the importance of that. I find it confining.
It does confine. That's true. Well, you see, the old word for this is called yoga. Yeah, the word yoga has something to do with the yoke in English. It's what you use to harness two oxen together initially. The word for commitment or dedication in Buddhist teaching is a verb that comes from that notion. You tie yourself together, you tie yourself to something. And you are perfectly right in saying that this constrains your movement. You know, you are less mobile. If you have one of these things on your back with somebody else, then you can no longer go left, and he can no longer go right in some ways. But together you can move more weight, yeah? You can pull more weight. Now, obviously, that is a limitation. That seems to take away some of your freedom. The point is that you choose this because you appreciate the value, you appreciate the freedom it gives you to pull more weight. Yeah? Now, there's different types of freedom. There's a freedom that allows you to move, that allows you to go where you like. There's the freedom of choice. There's the freedom of moving around, of not committing. If you do commit yourself, there's another type of freedom that comes with this. And if your notion of freedom consists of making continual choices, then you will probably cover a large ground. But it may be that you lose depth. Because you see, wherever you are going to dig, you will meet some type of difficulty and some type of resistance. It will become not easy. This is not an easy task. Growing awakened is not an easy task. And at some point, when you start applying a discipline, applying a yoga, you will meet resistance. And where, if meeting that resistance is the point where you're going to make other choices, you will probably go away from the same difficulty every time. So there's a certain repetitiveness in this pattern. And the only way I have found out of this is some type of commitment, you know, committing to a situation, committing to people, committing to a practice, and do that for a while. Now, I am conscious that my choices are likely to be wrong.
Yeah.
Whatever you choose is going to be at best as good as your current understanding. And if your current understanding isn't enlightened, you will notice you will make wrong choices. And there will be a moment where you have to assess, do I want to continue this or do I make another choice? But while you are doing this, I sense you have to commit. I don't think you can stay at the bus station and not choose a bus. I think you have to go on a bus, and maybe it was the wrong bus. Maybe you have to go back on the same line, the other direction. Maybe you have to take number 5 after you've taken number 3. But I do think you have to get on a bus. Because, you know, you don't get fed if you just read the menu in the restaurant. You don't get anywhere if you just stay at the bus stop and not take one. Yeah? So I have found I needed to choose, and I have made different choices in my life. I've chosen a Japanese vehicle for a while, and then I choose another vehicle for a while, then I choose a monastic vehicle for a while, and now I'm not a monastic anymore, as you see. So, but I have tried to commit myself at any stage of my practice to what I have chosen, and I have to confess I'm not committed to consistency. I'm committed to my understanding of truth. Now that has changed. I've tried to commit myself, and I continue to do so, to what I think is relevant. That has something to do with how I understand things. Now at any stage of my life, I have had people who told me, don't go there, don't do this. Once I was there, they said, stay here, do this, continue. Yeah? And this will probably continue. So I have found that a good deal of my freedom is in my ability to choose commitment, to choose constrainment, to choose depth instead of non-commitment, free roaming movement, because I realize the holes I'm digging are not very deep if I'm not actually prepared to stay put for a while. Now there may be other ways, you know, but this is my personal story. I've found that my freedom is in giving up at some degree of choice. That what I have becomes more valuable. You make things valuable by giving things up. It's very simple. Nobody likes to hear that. But it's very obvious. Every yes you say, it doesn't just hinge on the yes, it hinges on the no you are prepared to protect that yes with. You say, I marry you. How much is that worth if I say, I marry you? I marry you. Yeah? The quality of what you do hinges directly on your willingness. What are you prepared to give up for? It's very, whether that is a monastic life or whether that is a partnership, the principle is the same. You meditate, you do 5 minutes metta practice, 7 minutes anapanasati, then a bit of asubha, then a bit of kasina, then a bit of bhutanusati, you know. Any of them are very valid, very well documented, good practices. All of them together in 1 hour are perfectly useless. You know, well, not perfectly useless. It's better than, you know,
TV.
Watching TV. But they're mutually. Am I on track? Is this a response?
No.
Please.
I just want to add to the last statement, actually most of our life, most of the time, we're giving up most of things. We have to choose every time where to go, and we choose only one place. And at the same time, we don't go to other places.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
As you say, we marry one partner, at the same time we don't marry all the rest, we give up all the rest.
Yeah.
So most of the time, whether we want it, whether we don't, we mostly give up. And the idea of us choosing all the time we're free is, I think, mostly mental construction, a false mental construction. As a free person that chooses all the time the best choices, we want, the truth, it's mostly our choices are not conscious. are determined by the way we brought up, which we were various forces that we never chose.
Very true. This is great truth in this, because even if we keep making many, many choices, you know, the question is that there's a freedom. There's a freedom to do things, but there's also a freedom from things. You know, there's different types of freedom, and can you be free having to choose? You know. I'd like to make a break. This is interesting stuff. I'm conscious we could pursue that, but I'm also conscious time, major condition, and maybe some hunger. So we are half an hour behind schedule. I'd like to make a two-hour break, as the schedule said. And if that is correct, so we have 1:15. Could we meet back here at... three, meet at 3,
yeah,
and get going after 3, huh?
Mm-hmm.